Elise Glink, the owner of Think Link Media and Best Money Moves. ThinkLink.com is the website for Elise. Hi, Elise.
Hey, John.
Can I finish a comment I was making before the news?
Of course.
We were just talking about how tariffs might affect prices or maybe affect quality if we are going to have it made in the United States and want to keep the price the same. And we were getting various comments about some things that are made better or worse or the same as they quote-unquote used to be. 773 texted in and said, I own 15,000 toy Transformers in my collection. I sell them for a living. It is a misnomer that they were made of metal back in the 1980s. While it's true that many of the Transformers from 1984 to 86 would have a piece of die-cast metal in them, it usually was just their feet or a piece of their back or chest. The level of engineering that goes into today's Transformers far surpasses what was around back when the brand started. And then all of that to say this, this person says nostalgia is affecting people's memory about quality. Y'all think about that and come to your own conclusions. One more, 847 said, no, tariffs are not good. Manufacturing can move here, but you will pay a lot more. You'll pay three times as much, said this listener. We were also talking about the quality of cars. And what did you notice or say about that, Elise?
You know, it's interesting. A website called iccars.com, every year or so, they look at the most loved vehicles. And it turns out that the number of people who keep their cars for 15 years or more, it's a small percentage, right? I mean, think about your own car. It starts rusting or it doesn't work or it needs too much work, right? It's too expensive, just want to get a new car smell. Whatever it is, people trade out their cars all the time. But it turns out that of the 13 cars that people tend to keep the longest, the Toyota Highlander Hybrid is now the car that 7% of owners are keeping at least 15 years. And that's compared to the average amount that people would keep that car of under 2%. So 1.9% of people would keep those cars. That's the average length of time that people keep it. 15 years or more, 7% of owners do that.
Does that mean, so in other words, 1.9%. I'm a little confused by the 1.9%.
Well, the average number, the average amount hybrid of owner. Time.
The right. The average hybrid owner will keep it. I'm sorry, I'm confusing things.
Well, let's focus on the number of people, the percentage of people who keep cars for 15 years or older, because it's very rare to be able to keep a car for that long. I typically keep cars about 12 years. I'm working on my second, or maybe it's my third, I can't remember anymore, Honda Odyssey, even though my kids are old and grown and I don't have any kids or grandkids or you know, small animals that I'm transporting, I still find, you know, ways over at Costco every week to fill up my Odyssey.
Yeah.
But that's not a car that people typically keep a long time. You know, from when it comes to Hondas, the Honda CR-V, 6.3% of people keep that car for 15 years or longer.
And that's number 6 on the list.
Right. And number 12 is the Honda Ridgeline, where 5.5% of owners keep that car for 15 years or longer.
Okay.
But on the top 13, Toyota has 7 of those spots, and people really like those cars.
Highlander Hybrid 1, Camry Hybrid 2, Toyota Highlander 3, Tacoma 4, Prius 5, Honda CR-V 6, Ford Escape Hybrid 7, Toyota RAV 4, Lexus IS 350, Nissan Versa, Toyota Tundra, Honda Ridgeline, Subaru Forester, number 13.
Yeah, I also like to say that there's a real financial reason to keep your cars, to buy them if you can outright, and then just hold on to them for as long as you can, just to keep driving. Now, you and I have talked about the average price of a car, which is now around $45,000 for a new car. It is so much cheaper to buy a car and then keep it for those 12 to 15 years, and then buy a new one and keep that one. And the amount that you'll be able to save over a lifetime of doing this is probably about $225,000.
Rather than making new car purchases, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, or even, you know, and this is including if you get a loan and you have to pay a little bit higher price for that.
Right,
it includes that. And that's because after the loan is paid off, most people, you know, get a loan to buy a car today. It's expensive. But after the loan is paid off, you then will have a number of years where you don't have to pay anything on the loan. And that money, excuse me, I'm a little hoarse from all the singing I did at a wedding over the weekend. But that will really add up in the bank for you. And so I really recommend that people try to buy an affordable car, even if it's a couple of years used, and then keep it for the long haul.
You're a wedding singer?
I'm not. I was singing at a friend's daughter's wedding. You know how it is. You're dancing. You're singing to all the songs you know.
Oh.
It was fun.
So this wasn't you, the wedding singer. This was you partying at the reception.
Yeah, this is me just having a good time.
Elise, after you just talked about the kind of cars that people hang on to the longest, and again, the Toyota Highlander Hybrid was number one on the list. Let me turn the page to that again. The Toyota Highlander Hybrid, then the Camry Hybrid, then the Highlander, Tacoma, and Prius are the first five. And lots of love is coming in on our text line for Highlanders, Honda Elements, a GMC Yukon, a Honda Civic as well. Talk to me about something else, though, that you noticed. Pew Knight has a piece of research, the research firm. There's a story about what? Influencers on social media.
Yeah, you know, there was a lot of focus in the election about where people were getting their information from. And a huge survey, and by that I mean they talked to over 1,000 people, Pew Knight looked at where young adults are getting their news from, and it turns out that 40% of young adults are getting their news from influencers on social media rather from what you and I would think of as the main kind of media, right? Radio, television. Instead, they're getting it from places like TikTok and LinkedIn and, Instagram. And so they looked at all of these different places. And then they also looked at who these influencers were. And it turns out that more than 75% of them come from outside a newsroom, that just 23% of news influencers, so influencers who are talking about the news in the day, have studied that subject or were previously employed by a news organization. So they're delivering news, but they don't have training as a journalist. And so young Americans are getting away from this idea that journalists are the places that you would go or to, you know, journalism organizations to get that news. Now, 65% of these Americans say that news influencers on social media help them better understand current events and civic issues, which is really interesting, I thought.
Yeah, it's discouraging. I have often said when people say I get my news from Twitter or TikTok or whatever, it hasn't bothered me that much if, in fact, you're just using that platform to access News Nation, WGN Radio, The New York Times, you know, reliable sources, whatever. So the platform doesn't bother me so much. But this is different. This is influencers who aren't necessarily journalists or experts in these areas. And then I guess it still would depend on the influencer per se. I'm holding out hope that sometimes those people, you know, are reasonable and informed. But you're leading me to suspect that's not the case.
Well, for me, the bigger concern isn't whether they're, obviously I'm concerned whether they're informed and if they understand what the actual issues are. But when it comes to money and real estate information, John, I worry that the people who are the quote-unquote news influencers are actually making money from decisions that people are making. So traditional journalists like you and me, we don't make money when people listen to our advice. You know, I talked to you today about Toyota Highlander hybrids. I don't own one. I don't make any money if you buy one. I have no skin in that game, no financial skin in the game. But I think that of many of the so-called influencers I've seen, virtually all of them are making money from the advice that they're giving you. And to me, that taints the advice.
Yep.
And
yep.
It worries me
yep.
because there's so many red lines that get crossed because they're really not in, you know, giving you advice or information that may be in your best interest. It's certainly in their own.
What's this Redfin survey you also found?
Yeah, this is something else I think is pretty important. Redfin, which is a discount real estate brokerage, and they focus a lot on technology, they found that for people earning under $50,000 a year, that they're struggling to afford housing. And how much are they struggling? Well, about a quarter of them have skipped meals or drug prescriptions to make their payments. And that was really concerning to me because we do talk a lot about how, you know, 60-ish, 64% of people in this country are living paycheck to paycheck. And you wonder what that actually means. And well, what it means is that in order to keep a roof over their head, that they're having trouble, you know, making their mortgage payments or their rent payments. And that's concerning because there are, of course, we have hundreds of thousands of people who are homeless or unhomed, unhoused, as sometimes they're called, right now.
So what sacrifices did you have to make if you make less than $50,000 a year? If you make less than $50K, what sacrifices have you had to make to afford your monthly housing? Sold my belongings? 23% say they've had to do that to afford their rent. Moved in with other family members? 10%. Had to give up my pet? 6% say they had to do that because they couldn't afford it. And just one more that jumped out at me, at least. 7% said they slept in a car for a while.
Yeah, and you had 5% sleeping in a homeless shelter, 4% deciding against or delaying to have a child. And then, you know, the thing that we all do to make ends meet sometimes, you know, eat out at restaurants less. 43% of people are trading meals at a restaurant for their mortgage payment or their rent payment. I got that. But when you start borrowing from friends and family, you know, and then you're skipping your meals and you're working additional hours at your shift, or you're delaying or skipping healthcare and medical treatments, that's really a concern. There's also an interesting trend that people who are, you know, leading what we would call paycheck to paycheck lives are taking on side hustles. Now, this survey only found that 15% of people are taking on a side hustle to make their payments, either rent or mortgage. But John, we know that about 63% of Americans now have side hustles, and they use that for everyday expenses.
Information like this from Elise Glink at thinkglink.com. Thinkglink.com. Okay. Thank you, Elise.
Appreciate it, John.
Jim Dahlke is here, the Director of Communications at TechNexus Venture Collaborative. Jim, welcome to the show. Happy Monday.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
Grubhub sold to Wonder Group. Talk to us about this story today.
Yeah, Chicago-based Grubhub changes hands yet again. So Grubhub bought really at the peak of the pandemic by Just Eat Takeaway. They took Grubhub private after Grubhub, you know, famously went public, and at one point it reached over $10 billion market cap as a public company. They were acquired at the height of the pandemic back in 2021 by Just Eat for $7.3 billion. And just last week, Just Eat sells the company to Wonder Group, another delivery and takeout food startup, for only $650 million. So this is an extremely steep discount for Grubhub here, who really kind of is really one of the poster childs of Chicago's startup community, right? So this is a business that was that began at the University of Chicago, participated in its prestigious New Venture Challenge startup competition. You know, it founded by Matt Maloney and local startup vets, and really built this into one of the dominant food delivery players, and you know, was really one of the largest players in the space here in the U.S. And then really has struggled to kind of compete with the emerging competition from those like DoorDash and Uber Eats. And now we see Grubhub selling for much, much less than it did just a few years ago.
So just to be clear, because one of the interesting sentences I saw today was that Wonder, as you mentioned, will pay $142 million in cash and take on $500 million in Grubhub debt. And I'm thinking, wait, what does Grubhub do? They don't have huge capital costs, right? Don't they coordinate the delivery of food? How do they acquire $500 million in debt? I guess I don't know about businesses these days.
That, That's a great question. We'd have to really dive into the financials there to figure out exactly where the $500 million in debt came from Grubhub. But what's interesting here is Wonder is, you know, this is a venture-backed startup itself. This is led by Mark Lurie, who's a former Walmart executive, which is now, you know, working on a food delivery business of itself. So this is a venture-backed startup that, you know, raised about $250 million in equity in recent news as well. So, you know, this is a company now that will have Grubhub and the Grubhub brand. And so far, they don't plan to sunset the Grubhub brand. So Grubhub will still be around as a brand name. But yeah, interesting to kind of see what this business now will be able to do, you know, with Grubhub as a part of its family of businesses. But yeah, interesting kind of turn of events here for Grubhub.
And just kind of a whole new category anyway. I mean, if Grubhub isn't the dominant player or doesn't exist after a while, that category is going to be there, right?
Yeah, the category isn't going anywhere. It's certainly not what it was in late 2020 and early 2021, right? You know, what we saw is everybody was home. You know, food delivery absolutely skyrocketed. That has certainly come back down to earth. And then for consumers, right, I mean, the price of food delivery is, you know, in some cases, not attainable. It is very difficult, right? It's the cost of food has gone up, and the delivery services, you know, compare it to just picking up food yourself, right? It's a major jump in price there. So I think for a lot of consumers, just the juice wasn't worth the squeeze. But as a category itself, food delivery is not going anywhere. But I think we're a long ways away from getting anywhere close back to the COVID era days of food delivery.
Home Thrive, talk to me about this startup.
Yeah, this is a Chicago startup, just raised $20 million in new venture funding. They're an interesting business. They are really all around senior care for at-home caregivers. So let's say, for example, you've got a mother-in-law living with you, you've got a grandparent living with you. Home Thrive is a platform for all about giving you resources and tools to help care for that loved one. So they provide one-on-one phone call support, live chat, curated articles, guides, webinars, all different kinds of, you know, different vetted information and tools to really help you care for that loved one at home. And actually, they offer it as an employee benefit through your employer's health plan. So really interesting kind of take on making it, you know, more attainable to take care of an aging loved one rather than sending them to some facility. And just got $20 million in the bank to grow its business.
They are a resource. They're not the provider of the services, though. Do you understand that? Do I understand that?
Yeah, that's correct. So what they are able to do is provide 24/7 on-demand digital resources. And they can also connect you with guidance with some of their experts. So, you know, you as the caregiver, you know, are in charge, and they're helping you get tools to provide better care, which they say over time, you know, can lower costs and provide better outcomes.
There's another local venture capital firm story you guys have today. Talk to me a little bit about this.
Yeah, so Chicago Ventures has got $80 million to invest in more startups. So that's great news, obviously, for Chicago startup ecosystem. We've got, you know, more money to be invested into local companies here in Chicago and elsewhere. So $80 million. This is the fourth fund for Chicago Ventures. Builds on the $63 million they raised for their third fund just a few years ago. And so Chicago Ventures is a funder of lots of well-known Chicago startups, Spot Hero, Project 44, Cameo, M1 Finance. So more money in the backyard of Chicago startups is always a good thing.
So that's the aggregator of funds, it sounds like. Where do they come from? Whose money is coming into Chicago Ventures? Where are they based?
Yeah, so Chicago Ventures, like the majority of VC funds, you know, its limited partners are a wide swath of different folks, for high net worth individuals, family offices, endowments, and so you know, they'll kind of canvas the traditional places where LPs will invest in venture capital funds. And so, yeah, basically it's a lot of high net worth individuals, family offices, endowments, things like that.
That's interesting because I think most of us, we think if I ever get to a place where I can retire or live comfortably, I won't put it at risk. I'll, you know, give Terry Savage my chicken money and ensure that I don't outlive my cash. These are people who evidently that isn't a concern. And this is a good thing, I guess, I'm trying to describe here, that God bless the people that are willing to put their money at risk and fund these sorts of ideas, right?
That's exactly right. In the venture capital game, really what you're looking for is that, you know, you're the spray and pray mentality of hopefully you'll catch one of these 100x returns, right? So you're going to get a lot of businesses that return 2x, 3x, 4x. Some will go to zero, of course. But in the VC game, you know, the goal is, hey, we're going to catch a kind of magic in a bottle for one or two of these businesses and really return that investment.
Spray and pray. Okay, that's Jim Dahlke, the Director of Communications at TechNexus Venture Collaborative. I'll call you next week. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Sean.
More business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Krasanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Mizcon America, the company that makes Ragu pasta sauce, is moving its North America headquarters to Schaumburg from Mount Prospect. Grains reports the relocation will happen late next year. Mizcon will be the new anchor tenant in an office complex near Woodfield Mall. The company has signed a long-term lease for more than 50,000 square feet of space at Woodfield Corporate Center on Martingale Road. Mizcon also has the Bertolli brand. Chicago-based HomeThrive has raised more than $20 million in a new funding round. It's a healthcare startup geared to helping senior citizens live independent lives. Chicago Inno reports the funding will help the company begin its next stage of growth. HomeThrive provides care management and personal assistance services to seniors. The new funding will help expand the HomeThrive platform, including artificial intelligence-driven navigation. The company was founded in 2018. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thank you, sir. Business of Food, Steve Alexander.
Thank you. And last week, we heard an economist from the American Soybean Association warn that the winners of another tariff war would be farmers in Brazil and Argentina, to whom China and other U.S. trading partners would turn for cheaper soybeans.
And that's a long-term consequence as well. Even when a trade war ends, we saw last time around, that once land goes into production in Brazil, once they convert land into cropland, it's going to stay in cropland.
And it isn't getting any easier for U.S. farmers to compete with Brazil, as more land is being planted right now into soybeans in Brazil. How much more? After I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today, there's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, remember this song? 1964.
My mommy said not to put beans in my ears.
We have beans coming out of our ears. The worldwide supply is at record levels, and in Brazil, where it's springtime right now, farmers are planting soybeans, and as they have nearly every year, they are planting more. But
this marks the slowest growth in a decade, driven by lower profit margins for farmers.
Yeah, farmers down there are not immune to the low prices we've been seeing at the Chicago Board of Trade. But University of Illinois ag economist Joanne Calusi says Brazil is expected to increase acreage by about 3% to 117 million acres. Here, we plant about 86 million. But yield is the most important number.
In total, South America is projected to produce around 8.7 billion bushels of soybeans in the current crop season, contributing to what could be a record global production of 15.7 billion bushels.
And she says with all that supply,
with this global supply surge led by a record U.S. harvest, we may see further downward pressure on soybean prices.
And no shortage of cheap beans for the world's largest importer, China. On the food calendar, it's national... I need some help on this one.
Vichyssoise soup is how we would say it in France, but it'd be fine in English to say vichyssoise.
There you go. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Beth Swanson is here, the CEO of A Better Chicago, with some recent survey results. Beth, welcome to the show, and let's start by telling us, what do you do? What is A Better Chicago?
Hi, thanks so much, John, for having me. So A Better Chicago, we are a nonprofit venture philanthropy that invests in the most promising nonprofits helping children escape poverty. So we raise and pool money from our donors and invest those funds into nonprofits across the city that are working to really improve youth outcomes and really along the cradle to career continuum. So we invest in organizations working on everything from early childcare to K-12, post-secondary, and into workforce. Nice. We've provided more than $73 million in unrestricted capital and management support, and, you know, served through all of the organizations we support. We serve about 115,000 Chicago students to date.
It's interesting. We just talked to Jim Dahlke about venture capital and how money pours into some of these umbrella funds that then find companies to invest in. You sound like that on the philanthropy side.
Exactly. We really have modeled ourselves off of venture capital, and we, you know, do just that. And we try to partner very deeply with the organizations we fund and provide additional support, take a seat on the board, you know, help them through different strategic decisions as they're looking to grow their impact. So very much analogous.
Who are some of the bigger recipients then of your funds?
So we support organizations all over, predominantly the South and West Side, but I would say all over the city. But we try to get to the leaders that are most proximate to the issues of poverty in Chicago. A few different examples, you know, and I should also say we organize ourselves around three funds, from the earliest stage organizations to the more mature. Some of the more mature organizations are probably more the household names, like 1 Million Degrees, Chicago Scholars, College Possible, many in that post-secondary space helping youth really to and through two-year and four-year college. And some of our earlier stage investments include The Block, which is, you know, an academic enrichment program, but also through uses the sport of boxing.
Oh, yeah.
To bring kids in and, you know, provide with mentorship, academic support. That's, well, on the West Side.
I understand that you all did a survey to sit, and well, you should, to maybe see where the money should be best spent. What feedback did you get when you asked people what are their needs or concerns?
Yeah, so this is the second year we've done this, and really trying to get a representative sample of young people in Chicago and get to, you know, the, kind of our ultimate beneficiaries. So we surveyed this past summer, most recently, 400 youth ages 10 to 24. And what came of that is, you know, they obviously, young people are facing many challenges, as many of us know, including issues around community violence, mental health concerns, chronic absenteeism. You know, nearly 94% of youth surveyed see mental health concerns as a major challenge they are facing. Two-thirds have witnessed community violence, and nearly a quarter of those say they witness it weekly. And nearly all want more community-based programming, including weekends and after-school, summer. And, you know, that's a lot of the organizations we, you know, we invest in are providing those sort of critical services. And we heard loud and clear that young people really, they need more, and they want more access and opportunity. Hmm.
What do you want our listeners to do? How can we help you all do what you do, Beth?
Yeah, well, we're always looking for partnership and support, you know, which is at betterchicago.org. Very easy to find us on the web. And I would say also that one of the largest findings we thought coming out of that survey was that despite all of those challenges, almost all surveyed, 95% of the young people in the poll said that they are optimistic about their future and they're planning to attend college. And so that felt like just validation of the Better Chicago's work and others in this space. And it's upon the adults in Chicago to really help young people see that vision, and we just need to invest in their future. Hmm.
Beth Swanson is the CEO of A Better Chicago, abetterchicago.org. Click there. And Beth, we'll call again. Thanks for the insight today.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for having me.